have this weight in my pocket, and all of a sudden I was wondering what that was, thinking it was my phone, but of course it is my microphone. Welcome, everyone. It's really fantastic to be here. Lee acknowledged the Gadigal people. I would like to do that also as the traditional owners of the land in which we meet. When you think about migration, and we're talking about, in our report, contemporary migration, I think it does give you a moment of pause when we then think about traditional owners and the impact that migration has had on them. Migration for hundreds of years. And I think this is an opportunity to reflect on that and to reflect on their lives and how, certainly as a non-Indigenous Australian, what our impact has been on them, and to do that in the spirit of understanding our shared histories. So in saying all that, I would like to pay my respects to the traditional owners and thank them for their custodianship of this land and their culture. Migration. It's an interesting topic, isn't it? One that certainly garners plenty of response and many and varied views. I can tell you, having launched a number of research reports for CEDA now, this report is the one that prompted the most immediate and highest volume response to me personally through the CEDA info email. And you can imagine what some of those looked like. And we had a couple from people who really did declare themselves as everyday Australians. And I say that because it is a reminder to us that while we will focus on a particular part of migration and our report really hones in on the temporary skill aspect of this, that there are community concerns around what this program and what migration in general means for everyday Australians. And one of the reasons we did this report was to address those concerns head on and to try to put some facts and some evidence into the space and actually to put forward some recommendations that responded not just to business concerns but also to community concerns. And that is how we will try to frame up all of our work at CEDA. The idea that we can now put forward recommendations and advice without understanding or attempting to understand what those recommendations mean for the broader community, I think, is long gone. So this is, I just want to call out very explicitly, one of the reasons why we undertook this research. But if I take a step back, Lee also spoke to the broader CEDA research agenda. And last year we did a piece of work called Connecting People to Progress, where we actually wanted to look back on Australia's economic development and to understand which of those factors were critical to supporting Australia's long track record of economic development, and look at those from the perspective of understanding them well and thinking about how they needed to change in order to build future prosperity and economic and social development in Australia. And one of those is squarely in the centre of population. And pretty much everyone knows that. Immigration has shaped this nation culturally, it's shaped this nation socially, and it has absolutely shaped this nation's economy and will continue to do so into the future, as we call out in the report. So this is the first of what will be ongoing research for CEDA, looking at the topic of population immigration and how we can shape the policy and the conversations to drive better outcomes for the economy, for the society, and also reflect the implications for the environment as well. Now, before I get into the nitty-gritty of this report, it would be remiss of me not to call out, I'm scanning the audience for Gabby. Ah, well, you're hiding behind someone. So we have the pleasure today of having in the audience two of the authors from our report, Gabriella D'Souza, who's sitting there, who works with us at CEDA, and Henry, who's at the back there, who contributed the chapter on the trends in migration as well. So I just want to call them out and just highlight that if you have any specific tricky questions about that, I will be pointing them out in the audience. Okay, now. This is trends in migration. Over the past 70 years, 7 million new Australians have called Australia home. 7 million migrants coming to Australia. That's a massive number, isn't it? But let's make it even more stark. 2 million of that 7 million have arrived in the last decade. And when you think about that, you look at the chart, the big bar at the end is essentially the last decade. It's not surprising that immigration has become and remains a huge topic of interest for pretty much everyone in Australia. But we've managed those levels of immigration pretty well on the whole. The Scanlon Foundation research shows that 80% of Australians believe that migration has been good for Australia, which is a really positive thing and something that we should speak to always. So while we have our debates and there are contested views, on the whole, people understand this has been a positive for Australia. But there are concerns, and there have been concerns, particularly in recent years and decades, about the level of migration. I thought I would remind you of a quote from Bob Carr, who now is actually with the University of Technology Sydney, I think, looking at issues of sustainability, who remarked as the then New South Wales Premier in 2000 that you've got a lot of people in Sydney concerned about the rate of urban consolidation. And if I said that today, you would think that was a contemporary quote and not one from almost two decades ago. So this is nothing new. Many of the concerns, of course, centre on the scale of immigration, where migrants settle, primarily in our largest cities, and whether and what impact immigration is having on public amenity, social cohesion, education, jobs, etc. Interestingly, I was reminded just the other day that for immigration purposes now, anything other than Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and Perth is considered regional. So it just highlights, in a sense, how concentrated so much of the migration stream has been into those four capital cities. What does this mean? It means we must continue to have really open, honest, broad, comprehensive debates about immigration, about population and about policy. And when I say comprehensive, one of the things I want to call out is that for most people, when we talk about immigration, we tend to speak about permanent migration, or I think that's what settles in people's minds, which is why actually we wanted to call out temporary migration and the role that temporary migration is playing. Lee mentioned the figure. At the moment, 2 million people in Australia as temporary migrants. That's actually a big number, isn't it? And I think a bigger number than many people would actually realise. We've got 2 million here now. Temporary migration has also been a feature of Australia's history for longer than the last decade, but of course it's picked up steam recently. So let's have a look at who these temporary migrants are. Hopefully you can read that, but the big bar on your right, my left, is New Zealand citizens. Roughly a third of all temporary migrants are New Zealand citizens here on temporary, with temporary rights. Education. Students here on temporary education visas, probably not surprising to most of you and certainly not to the university, I would have thought. Interestingly, international students do have work rights. They can work 40 hours a fortnight while they're studying, and outside of semester they can work as long as they like, and anyone who's been in an Uber probably has had a conversation with a student working. About 50% are working in some formal capacity in our labour market. There are around 230,000 who are here on bridging visas. That means they came on one visa and they're transferring or transitioning to another visa or have applied to do so. That is also a big number and one that surprised me. We've got about 135,000 working holiday makers, and then finally almost 150,000 temporary skilled visa holders. So we're focused largely in the report on temporary skill migration and its impact, but firstly, I think one of the things that surprised me was it actually doesn't stand out amongst those other categories all that startlingly. So that was a bit of a surprise for me. This is a snapshot of where we are now. It's just worth highlighting that, of course, temporary migration is very responsive to policy and it's very responsive to economic conditions. So just to highlight that, at the height of the resources boom, there were about 680,000 primary temporary skilled visa holders in Australia. At the moment, there's about, in the resources sector, there's about 32,000 now. So that just shows you how responsive that is. And of course, the really strong growth in student visas has been in response to not only our strong economy, but also changes in policy. How does temporary migration impact population as we measure it? I have to say, Henry's done all these calculations for us. This gets a little bit confusing because when they do the population count, they actually count the net migration impact, which includes temporary visa holders. But of course, over time, what really influences it is that the impact on population is the number who stay on permanent visas. So to put that into perspective, in 2016-2017, temporary migrants accounted for over 70% of net migration, which is arrivals less departures, and 45% of total population growth. Over time, if you look at the last decade, there's been population has grown by 3.7 million, with 2.25 million driven by net migration. And of that, there were 1.9 million permanent visas that were offered. So you can see that initially, net migration has a really big impact, but what ultimately drives the long-term impact on population in Australia is the number of permanent visas. Alrighty, that gives you a bit of a sense of the landscape of numbers. One final thing I thought that would be worth highlighting is that in the past, temporary skilled migration has been something of a de facto path to permanent residency. So, which is sort of relates to that 1.9 million. There's some changes in 2017 that have made that more difficult, but prior to that, about 55% of temporary skilled migrants stayed permanently. The other thing that surprised me was I think there's a perception that maybe more students stay, or a reasonable number of students end up staying permanently in Australia, but actually 84% end up going home. And if you have a look in the chart in the report, we sort of look at that number as over 20 years who ends up staying. But if you look at the chart and you look at how it transitions, actually most seem to be heading home just about when you would expect them to. You know, 4 or 5 years after they've started, it kind of makes sense. So, but that number, 84%, actually surprised me. So what's the impact on... I'm terrible, I have to say, at clicking my slides. So let's see. Well, I'll come back to that one. Just make sure I don't get ahead of myself. So the big question, as I said at the outset, is what's the impact on our labour market? So we often hear temporary skilled migrants take the jobs of Australians. They have an adverse impact on jobs and wages in Australia. So that's where we brought in Gabby to bring her fantastic economic modelling skills to give us an updated answer to that question. So the Productivity Commission had done some work on this that sort of looked at things up to about 2012, and Gabby's updated that modelling work to have a look at what's happening, particularly when you've had the strong immigration recently. And the short answer is that our modelling work showed that there has not been an adverse impact on participation and wages or unemployment. And in fact, for certain groups with certain skills and expertise, the impact's actually been positive. And we call out in the report that there are other ways in which, if you just think about it, you've got temporary skilled migrants coming in, they earn, on average, very high wages, they spend those wages in our economy, they pay their taxes, and actually they don't have access to government-provided services. So it's probably not surprising that to have them in the workforce, they're contributing, to have them in the community, they're bringing more income and spending. So it is a positive. And we felt it was important to... This is independent research. It's looking at the aggregate impacts, but it presents a very compelling argument about what the impact has been. I should call out, you'll see the results highlighted in our report, but if you have a bit of inner nerd and you want to understand the modelling, there is actually a full modelling appendix that's available on the website. So if you want to go and check it, make sure that Gabby's done everything right, then by all means, please do. And you can email me at the info email address with any complaints on that. So let's talk about this in a little bit more context too. Temporary skilled migration. One of the things that, particularly when we're talking to the media, we're very upfront about. Do we think Australia's education system needs to improve? Absolutely. Always. Particularly vocational education and training. Do we need to do everything that we can to make sure that people in the workforce now and our young people training have the skills and expertise needed to get the jobs that we have now and in the future? Absolutely. We do not see temporary skill migration as somehow plugging that absolute essential need in the Australian economy. The fact of the matter is, though, that no matter how good our education system is, there are always going to be skill needs in this economy that cannot be met locally. For starters, we have a really significant resources sector. Everyone knows investment in that sector is lumpy. When you look at the scale of the projects and the amount of skills and labour needed to deliver those projects, and to deliver those projects not just with the skills but the experience of having built these things in the past and used that technology, we're always going to need those skills. right? And they will. It's highly unlikely that we will ever be able to have that amount of skill and experience here. And if we did, what would they do for the 5 or 10 years in between projects? The second thing to call out is that our economy does undergo big structural shifts. We're undergoing a big structural shift at the moment. There is a huge demand for skills in the tech space. Anyone with cyber security skills, data skills, all of this, is in huge demand at the moment. And as a company director, I can also tell you that trying to find anyone who's got anything, a job title with the word risk in it, at the moment is also really, really challenging, and everyone's looking for it. So we are going to need these skills. And companies are using these skills not just to plug gaps, but to build expertise. The examples we cite in our report, Cochlear CSL, are they're tremendous examples of businesses here in Australia building more opportunity by importing skills and growing their own workforces. I've seen this personally when I was on the board of Woodside. They developed a grow your own talent strategy. Those graduates that were coming in were attracted by some of the skilled, temporary skilled migrants that were coming in and working at the top of the organisation, who had expertise and experience that no one in Australia could ever have. Ever. You know, we had someone working there who had managed the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico for BP. And you can imagine that how the bees flocked to that honeypot of knowledge, how much the young graduates wanted to soak that up. That is something that we do not talk about or acknowledge anywhere near enough. Now, let me get down to the process. So people sort of suggest that, I mean, implicit in this whole idea that they're taking jobs and whatever is that Australian businesses find it easier to go offshore and to bring talent in. That they would much rather go offshore, bring someone in, because that somehow is easier than navigating the Australian labour market. That's what it takes on both sides of the coin to come into Australia as a temporary skilled migrant. Now, to be honest, in some ways you look at that and go, wow, that's nuts. But the flip side of that is that that should also give people confidence that the system is working. This is not something you just pick up a page and go, you know what, I need someone to come and do this, I'm going to ring someone in wherever and bring them in tomorrow. This is about integrity. Now, does that mean we can't improve it? No. Does it mean we need to make sure that every aspect is actually working as efficiently and effectively and as well as it could for business? Because it needs to. Absolutely, we must. And we also must make sure that some of those steps that are actually responding to community concerns, like labour market testing, are actually worth doing. So, but just simply to say, this is not a cakewalk. It's not something you do because, you know, you haven't got anything better to do of your day. It's a serious endeavour, as it should be. Now, just again, to put this into context, you go through that process. We have many temporary skilled migrants here. They account for less than 1% of the total labour force. 1%. Even at the height of the resources boom, it was 1.4%. So this is not, you know, a tsunami of skilled workers coming into Australia. This is a targeted, challenging program. Okay, I mentioned before some of the characteristics of temporary skilled migrants. So who are they? Well, for starters, this is pretty much where they're coming from. The UK, India and the Philippines. They're young, they're highly skilled, they're well paid, average wage of $95,000. More than half of them work in four industries. And most of them are developers, ICT business analysts, university lecturers and cooks. Did that say 10 minutes, Jigal? Okay, thanks. 70% of them live in New South Wales or Victoria. Let's call that Sydney or Melbourne. 70%. Now, balancing the objectives of making sure we get those sorts of young, highly skilled people, but also building confidence in the community that we're not taking jobs from Australians is a difficult challenge. It does require a system with integrity, and we do need to maintain community confidence in that process. But if you think about the comments that I've just made about the size of the total temporary skilled workforce compared to the total workforce, if you think about their characteristics, if you think about the integrity of the process I just outlined, if you then think about that and then look at the history of reviews that we outline in our report, it seems completely disproportionate to the scale of this program. I mean, really out of whack, in my view. I can tell you that I was personally involved in one of these reviews many, many years back, and I can also tell you that before we actually finished that review, another review was announced. That is fact. And we only had 3 months to do our work. It's not like we'd been sitting on it for 12 months. So before our recommendations had been out there and discussed, another review was announced. The 2017 changes were significant, and I can tell you again for fact that sitting around a boardroom in a company that employs temporary skilled migrants, they were the focus of conversation. They did disrupt things, those changes. They were unexpected. There was not proper consultation. It was a huge disruption to workforce planning. That sort of stuff has to stop. So if I now just turn quickly to our recommendations. We think you can increase the transparency of the skilled list. Now, this is about getting more stakeholders involved, people understanding the methodology and the process and the data, so that you've got greater confidence that the occupations on that list really do represent skilled shortages. There are examples from overseas that we talk to that we think are good examples, particularly out of the UK. This is also about building community confidence. So it's not hidden behind closed doors. It's not a short sort of summary of this is what we think is happening. It's serious, credible analysis. This is a bit nerdy, but the occupation codes haven't been updated for ages. If you think about how quickly the labour market's changing, you've got to update those occupation codes. The ABS doesn't have the money. The ABS should have the money. So that's a no-brainer. It's pretty nerdy, but it's really important if we think it's going to keep working. Intercompany transfers. We all know big companies, they manage their workforces globally. At the moment, the process is too complex and it's just unnecessary red tape. So we think that should change. Creating an independent committee to look at this. Again, this is about building community confidence and trust in the system. And we need to stop the revolving door of reviews. You cannot have this persistent review process where every time something gets raised, you review the thing again and change it, and you don't let changes bed down, and you never actually understand what the impact of those changes are. So we've recommended that the Productivity Commission be tasked with undertaking regular reviews, 3 to 5 years, whatever we think, whatever the government thinks, so that there's a predictability and a rhythm to this that builds business confidence and community confidence. Because if you're changing something every 18 months, no one thinks it's working. No one thinks it's working. So that's just pretty crazy. So that's sort of where we got to with our report. We'll have plenty of time for questions and engagement on the key themes and issues. And it is now my great pleasure to welcome onto the stage our significant panel for conversation. If everyone would like to come on up, I'll introduce you.